Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. April is Autism Awareness Month. What we've learned about autism spectrum disorder is that we still have a lot to learn, like what causes autism, how many people are on the autism spectrum, and the best ways to integrate those living with autism into a normal life. All discussions that we'll have today, along with many others, with our guest in the first segment of today's program, Dr. Michael Murray is a child psychologist and director of the Division of Autism Services at Penn State Health Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. He's also director of the Central Region of ACERT, Autism Service Education Training. Dr. Murray, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
If you have a question or a comment about autism, maybe experiences, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Murray, Autism Awareness Month began almost 25 years ago. As I said in the introduction, we have learned a lot since then, but there still is much we don't know. In broad terms, what have we learned?
So I think in the last 20 years, as you described, when there's been increasing awareness of the needs of individuals with autism, as you also mentioned in the intro, working to integrate them more meaningfully into our communities, the power of early identification and early intensive treatment has done a lot to achieve those kinds of outcomes. So we know the power of early intervention delivered at a high intensity, meaning, we're talking usually between 30 to 40 hours a week, in a particular technique called applied behavioral analysis, which is a specific type of behavior treatment that seems to have the most efficacy for individuals with ASD and addressing their early needs. So, I think those kinds of things are becoming more and more apparent. And then we're also getting better at understanding what some of the emerging needs for individuals are across the lifespan. So one of the things I do a lot of my research in is in social skills for adolescents and young adults, and really kind of trying to understand how can we give them the tools and techniques that they need to be more successful in integrating into social environments that they're so highly desiring for. I think one of the biggest misconceptions that's been clearly disavowed over the last 20 years is that people with autism really aren't interested in people. We know that absolutely is not true, that they want friendships, they want relationships just like anyone else might want. It's just that they really struggle to have the right sets of tools in order to make those kinds of things happen for themselves.
Something you mentioned, and I'm going to define terms as we go. You said ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorder.
Correct.
Which brings up a question that's a relatively new term. What is autism spectrum disorder? And maybe I'm not looking for the definition, because that's my question there is, what is autism? But what is the autism spectrum?
So you're right, the term ASD, autism spectrum disorder, is relatively new. With the latest edition of what we call the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, fifth edition, so everyone calls that DSM-5 because it's a mouthful. So DSM-5 came out with this reconceptualization of autism as a spectrum disorder, which we've recognized all along that there's varying degrees of disability or impairment or challenge that an individual might experience in two main areas as defined by the DSM. So one is in the area of social and communication. So those are type things that maintaining eye contact when you're speaking to someone, understanding nonverbal communication, being able to have those tools and abilities to maintain appropriate peer relationships as you may want for yourself, all those would fall under the social communication. And then there's the set of things we call the restrictive and repetitive behaviors. So those are things that an individual may do in order to kind of regulate themselves in their environment. So oftentimes we'll see young children engage in something we call stereotypies, which are repetitive motor movements. So sometimes hand flapping or body rocking as a way of trying to control themselves or regulate themselves in their environments. And then as people age, sometimes they will develop what we call non-functional routines, the just feeling the need that they have to do certain things certain ways all the time in order to manage their anxiety or make the environment more predictable for themselves. So all of those types of things fall under that second domain. Mm. And then people can have various degrees of challenge with those two domains, hence the term spectrum.
I ask about what we've learned over the past 20 years or so. What haven't we learned? What don't we still know?
So the big one is we don't know what causes it, right? So we are starting to understand some genetic vulnerability. We understand there's certain gene sites that potentially if you have one of these gene markers, you may be more likely to develop autism, although it's not 100% predictive. We know there's certain risk factors that you can be exposed to in utero that may also make it more predisposed to having autism. But even at this genetic level, knowing these vulnerabilities, we still don't know how that translates into autism and what we see as the behaviors and challenges associated with it.
With genetics, most people, when they think about genetics, think, okay, this has been handed down from generation to generation. Is that the case, or are we talking just about something, a gene in the body that is different?
It could be both. So certainly if you have a family member with autism, you yourself are more likely to have autism. So the overall risk of autism in children is about 1 in 59. So 1 in 59 children across the United States will go on to develop an autism spectrum disorder. If you have an older brother or sister with autism, your risk goes up to about 1 in 10. So there's certainly something about, you know, an inheritability factor in it. But by and large, most cases of autism are still a single case within a family. So there's a lot of variability even in that.
When you say that there are some other factors like in utero, like what?
So the most widely known one recently is women who might take a drug called Depakote to manage seizures or mood challenges. Those babies are at much higher risk for developing autism.
Mm. What about like alcohol or drugs, smoking cigarettes, marijuana, anything like that?
So there is a condition called fetal alcohol syndrome, which is where an individual will manifest if their mother were drinking consistently and perhaps heavily during the pregnancy. Those individuals will develop a cluster of symptoms, physical findings as well, and they are also at much higher risk for developing autism.
What is the difference, if there is any, between an intellectual disability and autism?
So intellectual disability can co-occur with autism and does so at pretty high rates. So estimates between 40 and 45% of individuals with autism will also have an intellectual disability. So an intellectual disability is challenges with your cognition. So having trouble retaining facts, executing those facts, you know, things that we could catch on an IQ test, but also kind of just looking at someone's overall adaptation. You know, are they developing the skills that you would expect in the trajectory that you would expect them to? All those things go into considerations for an intellectual disability. There are people with autism who actually are quite gifted intellectually. You know, they, you know, have IQs 130, 140. They can become quite accomplished successfully. Where the difference is the challenges that they experience are really focused in on the social communication we just talked about, the restrictive repetitive behaviors we were talking about, and it's not a broad challenge of processing information that you would see in someone with intellectual disability.
You mentioned 1 in 59 in the United States. One of the things that I've noticed in researching this program, and you know, I've heard over the last few years, there seems to be some disparity in numbers. 1 in 59, I think, is accepted by most here in the United States, mm-hmm. but have seen numbers as low as 1 in 35. I know there was a study in Denmark a few years ago that said 1 in 35 children born would be born on the autism spectrum. Why the disparity?
So that all comes into how the methods are sampled, right? So the U.S. prevalence figure through the CDC is coordinated through a multi-state surveillance system. So they look at every child who is receiving educational services, which hopefully is every child in those states. And there's, I believe, eight that they're following right now. And they look at their educational records to see where, what kind of services they may be receiving in school, how they identify, what are their educational records looking like. So it's very intensive, and it's a very intensive look at them. Whereas other studies are looking at something we would call claims data. So in Denmark, for instance, they have a national health system. So they have one database where all their health claims are processed. And they are looking to see how many kids have a ASD diagnosis as a claim. So there is perhaps some people who are, that they're diagnosed as an ASD at a claims level, which is, but it's not accurate. They really don't have, they have a developmental concern, but it's not autism. So there's some concern that maybe those numbers might be overinflated. However, over my professional career, when I was a medical student, the number, the prevalence number, it was 1 in 10,000, right? And we're to a point now it's 1 in 59. So it doesn't mean that they're wrong. It's just maybe we're not quite having the surveillance methods to get there yet.
Couple questions along those lines. When there is that disparity in numbers, now granted, you were talking about somewhere outside the United States as opposed to here in the United States, is there potential to misdiagnose or to not diagnose autism accurately?
Yes, to both. So certainly, there's been instances where people have an intellectual disability, but not autism. And sometimes at an early age, it can be difficult to tease that out. So that would lead to overdiagnosis. However, the more common is underdiagnosis, where individuals may have mild symptoms. And as a preschooler or an early, an early school-aged child, you have enough skills and abilities to keep up with your peers, so to speak. So play behaviors, which is the main mean of children, toddler, school-aged children interacting with one another, they're inherently like routine-driven, and there's a lot of structure to them, right? So when you play a game on the playground, you only need a couple of skills to be relatively successful with that. You need to have to follow the group, need to have to negotiate, take turns, be a good sport. And once you've learned the skills for, freeze tag is something we played when I was a kid. I don't know if they still do that, right? You can, it's not that much of a leap to then learn to play hide and seek, right? The structure is relatively the same. However, as you move into later childhood and adolescence, social communication becomes the means of brokering those relationships, right? So it's all about how you communicate. You may be doing something together, like shooting baskets, but that's just the secondary activity. It's all about communication. And then that's where the challenges start. So people who had been doing okay around the play behavior suddenly drop off the map when they need to use social communication, and then they will be caught at that point.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. WITF is partnering with Midtown Scholar Bookstore on a pick of the month. Read along with us and discover books we think that you'll like. April's pick is The Presidents by Brian Lamb and Susan Swain. It's available on April 23rd. It's this case for the best and worst of America's presidents. It's based on interviews collected over the author's decades-long tenures at C-SPAN, and presidents are ranked throughout the book. Lamb and Swain will be at Midtown Scholar Bookstore on Sunday, April 28th from 4 to 6 p.m. for a book signing and a discussion, which I will be moderating, and I'd like to see you out there. If you'd like to attend, go to WITF.org, and you can RSVP to attend the event April 28th at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore. So again, invite you to come out. I think that you'd enjoy it, and especially with all those history buffs we know that we have out there. It is April. I should say April is Autism Awareness Month. We are talking about autism on today's Smart Talk. Our guest, Dr. Michael Murray, child psychologist and director of the Division of Autism Services at Penn State Health Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. He's also director of the Central Region of ACERT, Autism Service Education Training. We welcome your phone calls, your comments. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Murray, we're going to be joined by a family here in just a few minutes that has lived what you have described here on the program. We have a young man who is on the autism spectrum, and we'll be talking with the Hartzells in just a few minutes. But I want to follow up on those numbers. You said, and I think this is quite telling for what we know and don't know about autism, that when you started, that it was considered 1 in 10,000 children on the autism spectrum. Now in the United States, we're looking at 1 in 59. We just said that some other places maybe even lower than that. What happened? What changed other than maybe how we diagnose? Are there more children being born with autism than there used to be?
So in the early 90s, the concept of the autism spectrum significantly widened. So prior to that, individuals who were classified or diagnosed as having autism would be individuals that we would today consider to be the most severely impacted by autism. And what happened in the early 90s is the concept of the spectrum kind of became established, and we understood that there are individuals living with similar challenges, but not to the same degree of impairment, or not with co-occurring cognitive challenges. And so the concept of the spectrum widened, and so that brought in a lot more people into it.
So that just meant more people were being diagnosed,
correct?
Right?
But that probably doesn't account for all of it. So there is probably some type of genetic vulnerability that is becoming more widely expressed. So One of the best things that I've seen, right, and this is still theory, so there's not proof to this yet, but there is, that we've widened the spectrum concept, but then maybe there's also some type of genetic vulnerability that is interacting with some type of environmental factor, don't know what that might be, to perhaps, cause more gene expression, which then is leading to more cases of autism.
It probably is a good time to discuss something that is very much in the news, and that is vaccines.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we could do a whole program on that, but right now we are seeing more cases of measles in the United States than we've seen since measles was officially eradicated in the year 2000. And much of that is because there are a number of people who are deciding not to have their children vaccinated against measles because, well, there are a number of reasons, but one of the major ones is that the vaccine causes autism. Your thoughts on that?
So the short answer is no. There's been several very well-designed large studies to look at the impact of vaccination on rates of autism, vulnerability, increasing vulnerability to autism, and there is no established link to that.
There was like one study that many people jumped on that has been debunked. Why is it so difficult for people to understand that that one study was inaccurate?
Well, I think that what makes the vaccination potential story as an attractive potential answer is a lot of families start to recognize that maybe the development of their child is a little off, somewhere between, around, 18 months of age. It is also at that point that children receive a lot of vaccinations. They have 12-month vaccinations, 15-month vaccinations, 18-month vaccinations. So there is, you know, obviously you want to, all of us want to answer, why is this happening, right? And it's something to point to. And then that study came out that suggested that there was a link, and it became a relatively easy answer. Unfortunately, it's not the answer, and we need to still do the work about why this is happening. But I think that's why it persists.
Do we know for sure that it is not a factor, especially when we don't know what causes autism?
So why we can definitively say it is not a factor is looking at, once again, I was talking about those large national data sets that, you know, some of our other Western countries have available because of national health systems. And they've done very sophisticated analysis over 20 years of those data sets, and that's the basis for understanding that this is not a factor.
Mm. Want to kind of switch gears now and bring in the Hartzell family. Joining us is Melanie and Zach Hartzell. Hartzells, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good morning.
Zach, how are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing very well today. So, Zach, how old are you?
I'm 19.
You're 19. Are you still living at home?
Yeah, with my family.
So you're still living with your mom and dad then?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Melanie Hartzell, tell me a little bit about Zach and when Zach was born and your journey through autism.
Zach was born with quite a few complications. He was born early, 5 weeks early, with some medical issues. Early on, he had some bowel issues. He had breathing issues. There were quite a few issues. So it took him about 5 weeks to get out of the hospital. He had three surgeries prior to leaving the hospital. So we knew early on there were going to be problems. At about 2 years old, we saw a geneticist, and he was diagnosed with a rare syndrome called Soto syndrome. And that, depending on where you pull the statistics from, is anywhere from 1 in 5,000 to 1 in 250,000. So there's a wide variety of that. The genetic testing was finally recognized in 2006, I want to say. So we did confirm he is diagnosed with Soto syndrome. He has an NSD1 gene mutation. However, a lot of children on the Soto syndrome who are born with Soto syndrome also show a lot of characteristics around autism. And we started to see these very early on. He had a lot of repetitive behaviors. He would crawl along and become frustrated and slam his head into a concrete floor. There were things that, although he had the Soto syndrome, there was a lot of it still didn't add up. So we started to see Dr. Murray when he was 4 years old. So he'd been with Dr. Murray a really long time. Dr. Murray did recognize he was on the spectrum for Soto syndrome. Throughout his life, we've dealt with aggression, lots of aggression early on. He had self-injurious behaviors. So he, a lot of the repetitive behaviors, the compulsive behaviors. So throughout our years, we've tried to figure out, you know, what are the best ways to deal with that? It took us a long time to find the right medications to get him on track. You know, at one point in his life, he was about 11 years old, we were actually considering out-of-home placement because we weren't safe in our home. However, today, you know, we've come a really long way. Zach has huge dreams of working for UPS. He's had these dreams
really?
Since he was 4 years old.
You want to work for UPS, huh, Zach?
Yes, I do.
What do you want to do?
I want to be a ride-along.
A ride-along?
Yeah.
Deliver some of the packages?
Yeah.
How did you get this dream? Do you remember?
Well, I go to school and learn how to be a UPS ride-along.
Mm. You know, that sounds like a fun. I think a lot of people would like to do that. You know, so Melanie, obviously, there have been challenges over the years, and you just described some of them, but there also are a lot of services today and a lot of help from people like Dr. Murray that is available today. What did you learn through this journey?
Well, we had early intervention from day one. When we left the hospital, they said he needs an OT immediately.
OT.
Occupational therapist.
Okay.
So he's had occupational therapy since he was roughly about 8 to 10 weeks old. Mm-hmm. So early on, because he had swallowing issues and he had a G-tube that we fed him through for the first 2 years. So, there were multiple medical issues getting through this. He had massive seizures. His first seizure lasted over an hour.
Wow.
We couldn't get him to stop. So that's kind of also caused some of the issues as well through his life, dealing with some of the medical problems. This last year we were traveling and he had a bowel obstruction and we were in Kansas of all places. So the medical issues still keep creeping up. But throughout this, we've had services throughout. So one of the big challenges was education. Early on, we were told from the very beginning, he has an intellectual disability. That, Mrs. Hartzell, that means life skills. That's what it always means, is life skills. I didn't feel that was ever right for Zach. It took me about 4 years to get him into an autism placement. And once he was in there, he thrived. He now, at that point, he was not reading. He didn't know basic number sense. So today, he reads on a second grade level. He can do addition and subtraction. He has some money sense. So those are all things that have helped us move towards his long-term goal of working for somebody like UPS.
What is the goal? I mean, every parent wants their child to be happy and maybe even establish some goals for them. But in a situation like yours and Zach's, what is your goal? What were you thinking? Were there goals? Maybe I should ask the question that way. Or, along the ways, were there markers, things that you wanted Zach to accomplish or you as a family wanted to accomplish?
Well, along with his dream to work for UPS, he always also wanted to drive a car. Mm. And for me, I always believed he would. And throughout his life, I've always believed that we can accomplish anything that he wants as long as we do the right things and we employ the right help. And so I've never been a parent that's been shy about saying, hey, I need help, or this is my issue, where can I find some assistance? He gets to about 15 and a half, and we realize, yeah, driving's probably never going to happen. So as a family, we got him a golf cart. He can drive a golf cart. So he drove a golf cart around our neighborhood for about 3 years until we found out that he shouldn't be driving a golf cart around our neighborhood. But it gave him a lot of independence. And lo and behold, when he started driving the golf cart and having that independence, the aggression dropped dramatically, almost completely. So
there was an outlet there.
There was an outlet. And he had some independence. And he was like the rest of the kids. And he was like his brothers. And, when he would talk about driving, it was, I want to be like you guys. I want to be like my family. I want to be like everybody else who can drive a car. So those are some of our struggles, because he does have those desires to be like everybody else with limitations.
Mm. Zach, did you ever think about what kind of car you'd like to drive?
Like a UPS passenger car.
You like UPS, don't you? The car or the truck? The van?
No, the truck.
Do you want to drive the truck?
Yeah. The package truck, right?
Yeah, the package truck.
Maybe we have someone listening from UPS today who could talk to Zach after the program. But, that's you know, again, I keep thinking that there are a lot of people who are like Zach who probably would like to drive one of those trucks and be a, in a ride along. So, Dr. Murray, I noticed that. Let me ask before I ask you this question, Dr. Murray, Zach, I noticed that you were reaching over and kind of patting Dr. Murray on the shoulder. You've known Dr. Murray for a long time. Is he a good guy?
Yeah, he is. Oh, Dr. Paul.
Dr. Paul must be a colleague?
Paul.
Dr. Pearl?
Dr. Pearl, I'm sorry.
Yeah, she's one of my colleagues that also works with Zach.
Uh-huh. But they're both good guys, huh?
Yeah, and the lady, too.
Dr. Pearl is a woman.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No first name there, so I didn't realize that, but that's good to hear.
We have to work on our social skills, Zach. What do you think?
Yeah, right. All right.
So, Dr. Murray, you've known Zach and Melanie for a long time. It sounds as if their challenges, they have had a lot of challenges. I can't ask if they're typical, because I'm sure everyone is different, but from what you've heard here, what you've observed, what you've treated over the years, are those things that we see very often in someone on the autism spectrum?
So I think that if you think about anyone's journey through life, right, and that there's periods in all of our lives where things are difficult, right? So early adolescence and going through puberty and all the, all the storm that can create for anyone. But if you take any of those developmental challenges that is just part of life and then realize you have a developmental disorder where you are inherently going to struggle with those, it becomes, much more difficult to get through those periods. So that variability is what we see all the time in individuals with autism, that there's periods where things are pretty bleak, and a lot of times what happens is what can be discouraging for families is they kind of just get to a point where they feel like they can let their breath out, like, okay, we got this, and then the next developmental stage happens, and then they feel like they're hitting the reset button. It's difficult, because each developmental stage, you need new skills, you need new abilities, right? Zach is interacting with folks at a much different level than he did when I first started seeing him, because he's a young man now. And he's not, not a cute 5-year-old. So still cute though, Zach.
I also noticed that Zach is very affectionate in that, as I said, he patted you on the shoulder. He's been holding his mom's hand. Zach, do you like to interact? Do you like being around people and talking to people?
But I would not want to be around Jake.
Who's Jake?
Brother.
Okay.
I would not want to be around what I cannot drive, I can't. And you cannot drive. You cannot drive.
Is that what Jake says to you?
And that upset me. That really upset me.
Yeah. Well, again, my sister just had a birth the other day, and she birthday the other day, and probably would tell people that her older brother picked on her all the time. How old is Jake, Melanie?
He's 20.
He's 20. And is he picking on Zach like a big brother, or is he just watching out for him?
Both.
Okay. All right. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Just want to remind you that we have a Smart Talk road trip coming up on Monday. Monday is Earth Day, and we will be at Charles Tracy Mansion on Front Street in Harrisburg, talking about climate change for the most part, but a number of issues having to do with the environment and part of Earth Day that is coming up on Monday. There still is room if you'd like to RSVP and come out. We're looking at just a beautiful setting. Charles, it's beautiful to begin with, but right there along the Susquehanna River, and hopefully the weather is nice and we'll be outside. If you would like to attend and see Smart Talk as it's being produced, maybe participate in the program, go to WITF.org and you can RSVP, look for events and RSVP for our event, our Smart Talk road trip on Monday. Today we're talking about autism in not only Pennsylvania, but overall. April is Autism Awareness Month. We are joined by Dr. Michael Murray, child psychologist and director of the Division of Autism Services with Penn State Health Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, director of the Central Region of ACERT Autism Service Education Training. Also today, Melanie and Zach Hartzell are with us. Zach's mom, of course, is Melanie. Zach is 19, and we've been talking about their journey living with autism. We welcome your questions and comments. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Murray, Zach was diagnosed fairly early from what Melanie says. You touched on this a little earlier, too, of one of the things that we have learned in the last 20 years or so of how important an early diagnosis is. Why?
So understanding what a person's needs are in the period when their brain is rapidly growing and trying to establish new skills and new social interactions and targeting interventions in that period leads to higher chances that that individual is going to develop language, that they're going to develop social skills that allow them to be successful in a typical classroom setting where they can be around their peers and learn even more social behaviors. So really, we know that early intervention with that targeted applied behavior analysis really increases the chances of that individual being able to participate in a traditional school setting, which then keeps them on a trajectory to have a good outcome as an adult. You know, as Melody was saying, she fought really hard to have Zach be integrated into his school, and he's on his way to hopefully, I feel like I'm doing an ad for UPS, but on his way to working for UPS, you know, hopefully, right? So, you know, he's having a very great potential outcome, you know, as a young adult. And you'd be pretty happy working for UPS, Zach?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
You know, I saw you smiling, Zach, when Dr. Murray mentioned UPS. Man, you got this UPS thing going on. So, is that one of the real milestones today that, or the goals that someone who is on the autism spectrum is integrated into? I hate to use the word normal, but in a normal lifestyle, that that this person is able to function on their own, be accepted by other people in society. Just what is the goal?
So I think the goal is to allow individuals to choose the lives that they would want to lead as adults, right? And then put the structures and supports in place to allow that to happen, and to educate and resource the community to be able to accept that person, right? So it's a two-way street. We need to help the individual reach, you know, out to the community, but we also need to have the community reach out to the individual. But, you know, really the goal is, just as it is for any of us, right, is to figure out what brings value and meaning to our lives and being able to do that.
Is the community and society as a whole more accepting today?
Way more accepting, right? So, you know, the term, you know, so 25 years ago, as you mentioned, you know, we started the whole autism awareness because we needed to bring awareness to the issue. In the last couple of years, it's actually evolved to the term that a lot of times you'll hear now, Autism Awareness and Acceptance Month, right? With kind of the thinking's evolved that we need to now understand how to not see these individuals for the talented people that they are and figure out how to integrate them into our world, right? In a shared world. So, that, you know, so I think, you know, the thinking's evolving and we're getting there, but we still have work to do.
Melanie, I noticed that you were nodding your head in agreement when Dr. Murray was talking about society being more accepting today. Are they?
They absolutely are. My little brother had a learning disability, and he was pretty much bullied and picked on throughout early education. And that very much molded the way I felt about inclusion early on. I was dead set against it. I didn't want him exposed. I didn't want
people
laughing. Yes, I didn't want people laughing at him. today, and I'll tell you a story of something that happened last year. We were at Party City, and we were picking up something for a party somewhere. I can't even remember what. But there was a girl in line, and she kept staring at us. And I thought, oh, today's not the day. I'm not in the mood for this. And, you know, because he does get a lot of stares when we go out in public. And I get to the front of the line. I thought, please just don't say anything. Just don't say anything. And she said, Zach, right? And I said, yes. And she goes, I've had the pleasure to square dance with him at school. Mm. And I just felt it melted my heart. And I just felt, who's the stereotype person here? So it was really endearing. And it made me realize how accepted he is at school and how people really want what's best for
it's
him.
A nice story.
Yeah.
We have a question from a listener. I was born in the 1970s with gifted intelligence and ASD. undiagnosed until my 30s. There are many social areas where I still struggle. Does Dr. Murray have any advice for those of us with a hidden developmental disorder when we need to explain to others that high ability doesn't apply to every life skill?
Oh, that is so tough. So, especially for people who are gifted, right? Because we expect development to be uniform. So if you're gifted in fact recall, you should also be gifted in social navigation, right? And that's not true. So I think just, you know, for that person who submitted the question, you know, how comfortable they are in disclosing they have ASD. I think, you know, more and more people are understanding the challenges of ASD, you know, people meaning society and the community mm-hmm. at large. So I think that would be one is talking about, you know, trying to find advocates or trying to find champions that can help them navigate different social situations that he or she may need help in, as in a work environment or if it's in a some type of desired community participation. So I think that's first. Also, I think then just really kind of getting some social coaching. So one of the things that we do at the medical center is we actually have a social skills program for adults, like that caller was, where really kind of targeting what are the mechanics of social conversation? What are some things that can help you be more successful in navigating those interactions, understanding the integration of verbal and nonverbal communication? So those, I wish I could say do just this one thing. It's not. It's a lot of things that need to kind of be put together in a package in order to be more successful.
This young man said that he was not diagnosed until his 30s. We've been talking about early diagnosis, but does that still occur that there are people who are not diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum until they're an adult or well into adulthood?
Yes, unfortunately, that does still happen. One of our clinics over at Penn State is all about it's an adult diagnostic clinic because there are so many people out there who have questions about whether this is part of what their struggle is, and about half of the people who get referred into that clinic do end up having an ASD diagnosis that was undetected until their adulthood.
How are they treated, and maybe even treated differently than children?
So the early intervention window is closed, right? So we're looking at more of trying repair strategies. So we're looking at trying to, if that person is identified that I, you know, so first step is to identify with the person challenges that they may experience. And if they feel those challenges are barriers to accomplishing goals that they want, understanding what those goals are, kind of working with them to understand what the social skills or self-management techniques that may be necessary in order to achieve those goals. But it's very person-centered. You really need to understand what that person's goals and aspirations are and any potential barriers they're experiencing to achieving them, and then develop strategies around those.
Hmm. What about medications? I mean, Melanie was talking about medications, but it sounded like there were a number of issues there. But medications as a treatment for autism.
So there are two medications right now which have FDA approvals for treating conditions related to autism. So it's really important to understand that there is no medication for autism, right?
Right, so right, it's, right. It's like a cold or the flu or something like that.
But there's a lot of co-occurring conditions, right? So Mel and Zach shared that, you know, Zach had shared, you know, struggled with some aggression and self-injury, and, you know, that does happen frequently in individuals with ASD. So there's two medications, risperidone and aripiprazole, or Risperdal and Abilify, which have official FDA approval to treat the aggression and self-injury that can be part of autism. Anxiety is hugely co-occurring with autism, you know, and by the time people reach adulthood, about 65% of adults with ASD can also have clinically diagnosed anxiety. Anxiety treatment can be a critical importance of helping them manage their anxiety in different settings. That anxiety can predispose them to the aggression and self-injury, so it's really important to treat that as well. People with ASD also have high rates of depression. So anything that can happen to you or I as a mental health condition can also happen to people with autism, and it's important to treat those things.
I want to pass along a few comments that we've gotten here today. Kathleen from Palmyra says she's very passionate about the guest today. So I don't know whether congratulations or whatever, but I agree, too, that the three of you are just fantastic telling the stories. She says that her brother was diagnosed with autism in the late 50s, early 60s, one of the first applications of the diagnosis. And she says, I can tell you that I am my brother's legal guardian, and the knowledge, information is immense, and the changes from the 1960s to today is impressive. It is exponentially different than it was. Dr. Murray, I would assume you agree with that.
So Kathleen's brother definitely would have been one of the first cases. Autism was first conceptualized in 1944, so by Leo Kanner down at Johns Hopkins. So it definitely would have been a very new, and people would probably just be starting to have a very rudimentary understanding of what this might be. Certainly no treatment or understanding of how to best support those people, and achieve productive lives. So thanks for sharing that, Kathleen.
Also, daughter under 2 years old had a severe reaction to MMR. 20 years later, she's in grad school, but as a result of the reaction, we still don't know what the cause was. It was unspecified, so I'm concerned with the explanation research. MMR, is that vaccine?
Measles, mumps, and rubella.
Okay, that's what I thought. But still no explanation.
So there is about, depending on what study you look at, 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 100,000. Numbers vary, but 1 in 10,000 people who will develop an adverse reaction to a vaccination. It's not a... So definitely there are challenges for some people with vaccinations, but it's not leading to enhanced rates of autism.
We have another listener who says her granddaughter lives in Philadelphia, and she says that on the whole social spectrum, she has no confidence in making friends, but she hasn't been diagnosed. Wants to know if she could bring her to Hershey, but what kind of advice would you have for this listener?
So there's a couple of different routes that people can explore if they have concerns about a young person's development. So certainly the school system is one avenue, and you, as a parent, always can request an evaluation in school about potential ASD or any other kind of developmental concern that might be interfering with education. But what I heard the caller say was more about social concerns.
Right.
So certainly looking at a, I would look for people who are, I'm sorry, how old was this individual?
Didn't say.
Okay. But certainly as the kiddos get older, it becomes maybe more of a need to have autism expertise in order to recognize the signs of autism.
Mm-hmm. We only have a minute or so left, and I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. Zach, how do you feel today?
So am I. Excited.
You were excited to be on the radio, weren't you?
Yeah.
Is anyone listening that you know? Is your brother Jake listening?
Yeah, but all my school friends are listening, what the prayer was, and the prayer helper are listening also.
Well, that's good. That's good. And I'm glad that they're listening. You were great on the air with us today. I want to thank you, Zach, your mother, Melanie, Dr. Murray. Thank you all for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Coming up on Monday on Smart Talk, it is a Smart Talk road trip. As I mentioned, it is Earth Day. On Monday, we're going to be talking about the environment, climate change. We'll be at Charles Tracy Mansion on Front Street in Harrisburg. We encourage you to RSVP and come on out and maybe join in our conversation. You can go to WITF.org and RSVP for going to Charles Tracy Mansion. Everyone, have a good weekend.